So before we go any further, maybe we should stop for a moment and look at this term compassion in the Buddha's teaching. Karuna in Sanskrit. As usual, all the terms are defined for thousands of years, so we don't have to wonder what the Buddha meant by compassion. It might be surprising to hear this simple definition. Compassion is the wish that all beings, or anyone, oneself, another, or all beings, be free from suffering and discontent. So compassion is kind of like an attitude or a wish. And then, of course, that wish can manifest in activity. But it's a kind of intention. Often goes together with loving kindness, maitri, or in Pali, metta, which is similarly defined as the wish, may all beings be happy, or may I be happy, or may anyone be happy. So they're almost the same, it's just that maitri is may all beings be happy, and karuna is may all beings be free from suffering. Sometimes we even add in like the cause, so may me, you, and all beings be happy and have the causes of happiness, and may we be free from discontent, suffering, and the causes of discontent. So I think, you know, it kind of relates to John brought up this point this morning. Well, this one monk told her, laughed actually when she said, well, isn't compassion about going out and helping people? And he said, no, it's just about training your mind, something like that. So I think there is this strong element of that in the Buddhist tradition of this intentional mind training to access and open up our own loving kindness and compassion. And then we could say the point of that really is then to go out and actually have that naturally meet others and help them. Because if we try too hard to just, well, I should be kind and compassionate and let's go do it, we maybe get tired of it really quickly, or we get frustrated and so on. So the Dharma practice of shifting our attitudes and training our mind to be more open to kindness and compassion. And then, naturally then, we go forth and meet others in that way. And we meet others all the time, that we meet others, right? So there are these great examples, like going into areas where people are really destitute and really need a lot of help. Beautiful examples of compassionate response and kindness response. But in the non-discriminating way, we also, even people, you know, wealthy people who seem like they have everything they need, we also have compassion, kindness for them. And in fact, the irony of that is that, as I think we all know, that often those are the people who have everything who are often suffering most. I definitely have had that thought and sense traveling in places like India, third world countries, where poverty doesn't even compare to the you know, the homeless in India is a different situation than the homeless like in Santa Cruz. And yet often because they're so used to it and the people around them are so used to it, and maybe some kind of spiritual background, they often seem quite happy and content. They have their problems too, but it doesn't necessarily depend on outer circumstances. People are suffering because suffering in the Buddha's teaching is again an inner state of mind, actually defined as, because this relates to contemplation of compassion. If compassion is the wish to alleviate suffering, what is suffering? The Buddha defines as basically holding on, grasping anything with a sense of independent self, separate from others. It's kind of the definition of suffering, so we wish to relieve that. And then, of course, the outer circumstances make it hard not to grasp. Like if we're starving, we're going to really make a strong effort to get some food or something. Maybe even we're going to steal it, and we're going to get into a grasping mode because we really need this for our survival. So therefore, we work on the outer causes of helping people's outer needs. So I think it's always this mix. Like our own practice is the inner mind training that's going to manifest in the outer relationships with people, and alleviating others' suffering is also helping others understand what grasping is and suffering is, and it's also outwardly helping them to find a job or a place to live and so on. Well, I think it is true that in the Buddhist tradition, there is this more inner emphasis compared to, say, like Christian tradition. There's a lot about doing the outer works. So, compassion is the wish, wholehearted and sincere wish or desire that that someone or everyone be free from suffering and its causes. And it's at the same time a strong empathy with beings, really being with them, sensing their predicament. And because if we move ourselves too much, then we actually, the wish gets diminished, I think. We have to really feel and sense our own and others' suffering in order to wish for it to end.
Is it the English word compassion means with passion or with feeling?
I think passion can also mean suffering.
Yeah.
So calm could be suffering with others as a root.
The German word says it directly, Mitleid, which means with suffering,
with
as
suffering.
In suffering with a person.
But you know, that's how I often had heard as the etymology too. So I was a little bit surprised and delighted when I looked up the word compassion in Webster's dictionary. because it sounds so much like the Buddha's definition. This is what this Webster's dictionary said for compassion. Sympathetic consciousness of others' distress together with the desire to alleviate it.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
So that I was particularly surprised and delighted to find that desire to alleviate it, because that's really the definition in the old Buddhist tradition, is that wish or desire to end suffering. So it's in that English dictionary too. And sympathetic consciousness. Sympathy means the act or capacity of entering into or sharing the feelings or interests of another. Sympathos. And pathos actually means suffering, can mean suffering. And sim is like common, or common emotions or common suffering. So that's the maybe shared part. Sympathy maybe even more like suffering together.
Yes.
And then compassion is, it's a sympathetic consciousness or mind of others' distress together with this desire to alleviate it.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say that we have to come from an objective place rather than a subjective place with that compassion?
Meaning what?
To suffer with kind of sounds like you get drawn in and you're suffering with the person.
Mm-hmm.
And I usually think of it as caring deeply and giving love, but from an objective place.
Yeah.
Because that way you can help rather than go.
Yeah, it's a little tricky because the danger if we go, it's some kind of middle way here, I think. Because if we go too far apart, then we become like aloof and we're looking down and kind of pitying would be one. Sometimes they talk about the qualities of mind that are very similar to compassion but a little different. One of them would be like that sort of condescending pity. And another one is the other side that you just mentioned, which is grief and despair. And I think that's when we've gone too far into, we're like totally wallowing in other suffering. It's actually not helpful anymore. Sometimes I think we maybe feel like that would be good. Some people, oh, we got to really, we're saying too, we fall into either side. Either we're too far away, let's get really into it. And then we're just not helpful. It's just lost in grief. And then we can fall into the other side. Well, then let's not get too close to that situation. So, yeah, I think objective, but really open-hearted. Yeah.
It occurred to me that maybe the nuance is not so much that you don't feel the suffering, but that you accept the fact that despite your desire to alleviate it, you can't.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't go into grief because you can't.
Yeah, uh-huh. I had this conversation recently with people about what about situations where you actually cannot alleviate, like it's, you know, terminal illness or something. And then it can turn into grief, but part of the story here in the Buddha's story is that because of this definition, what is suffering actually? It's this holding on to the small self in the middle of whatever situation. So there's in theory, there's the potential that even if someone with like terminal illness, they're going to die, they're maybe in pain for the rest of their life. But even then, there's possibility, maybe not so likely, but you know, there is the possibility that they can be free in the midst of that situation. And therefore, that very reason, that kind of dharmic understanding, I think can prevent this grief, this total despair, like it's hopeless. Because in the Dharma realm, nothing's hopeless, actually. There's always a possibility that the perception can shift and someone can be, at least their load can be lightened.
That's where hospice comes in. And they do just that.
Compassionate care.
Yes, at the mm-hmm. end of life.
Yeah, they're not trying to prevent death.
No.
But they're
to ease the passage and mm-hmm. ease that for also the family members.
Yeah.
I know from firsthand because we have one of our moms died in hospice care and I became a volunteer as a result.
Mm-hmm.
It was just really fun.
Yep. Yes.
I can see an obvious difference between a word like apathy and sympathy. Do you think it's important to make a distinction between sympathy and empathy? So whereas with empathy, I've walked in your shoes and I know exactly what it feels like to suffer like you suffer. With sympathy, it almost seems like it's more of an intellectual acrobatic exercise. I can imagine as though I were you and what that might be like.
Mm.
It almost seems like it requires a higher level of like cognitive ability or something.
Maybe. I looked at both those words, empathy and sympathy.
Yeah.
These are all connected here. So just this Webster's dictionary. Empathy is the action of understanding, being aware of, or being sensitive to, and vicariously experiencing the feelings, thoughts, and experience of another. And then I think it said, without having the feelings fully communicated in an objectively explicit manner, which means like kind of intuitive. Mm-hmm. Oh, we should. Sister Erbol.
This
is the. So it means.
It's spiced. I don't know.
It's so complicated.
It's not spicy.
I don't know. Anyone know?
That's
the herbal.
It's the herbal.
Yeah.
It's different than it was the first time. It's steep longer, I suppose.
Oh. Herbal. So I think that means that part of empathy is that we, people don't have to say, hey, I'm really suffering. We have a sense because, I think we have that because we're humans and that looks more like herbal to me.
What did you say, because?
Because we share the same species. So I think we, when somebody is even a little bit upset, we often notice. Like, we can pick up on cues without them telling us. I think that's part of empathy. And being sensitive to these feelings and experience of another. And sympathy. So, again, empathy is just the action of understanding, being aware of, and sensitive to these feelings of others. Sympathy is the act or capacity of entering into or sharing the feelings and interests of another. Or sharing the feelings or interests of another. So very similar. It sounds more like empathy is more like the understanding and sensitivity, and the sympathy is more like actually entering into and sharing.
Yes.
Actually, like having the same feelings. Sympathy is common feelings. Almost like it's sympathy almost seems like closer, almost more intimate, like you're actually like connected to the same feeling. Mm-hmm. And empathy is more like you're just able to understand it. Maybe like a little more distance or something. Mm-hmm. And since I had the dictionary open, I couldn't help mm-hmm. also looking up suffering, which actually comes from the Latin a meaning of to carry or to bear something, which I think is, again, kind of nice. And if the Buddhist definition of suffering is like holding something, grasping or holding mentally something, to carry something is also like, it's like carrying a burden.
Yeah.
You could say like, well, there's this burden coming around with me, but to pick it up and carry it is the kind of holding to it. Maybe a little bit related. Mm. Or also pain, misery and distress, to bear those. Mm. So, yes?
Relating that to your earlier comments about the pillow.
Yes.
And that it's with a reach, and, you know, where I went with that was that, you know, metaphorically, that the pillow is the Zen experience, and that if we just rest our minds in its nothingness, we discover it. And there's something about what you're saying now that feels very similar to that. That if we just rest in the non-grasping, that the suffering is alleviated.
Yeah, and the compassion for ourselves and others is even opened up more there. I think just because, like, the sense of the small, contracted self drops away more and more. And then what's left is, like, this natural compassion. I think that's part of the, especially in the Mahayana teachings, it's like Buddha nature, which is like our true, empty, clearly aware nature. This is even in the Indian Buddha nature teachings, it's like we all have this actual nature, the same as Buddha's mind, that's like, that's just like an empty, open awareness is the basic definition. But then, so wonderfully, these Buddha nature teachings say it has qualities. This empty awareness is not just neutral. We might think it's just like zazen, spacious, and it has no care because it's so neutral. But these Buddha nature teachings say it has these qualities of great compassion. Mm-hmm. I think that's so wonderful that our true nature, which is often blocked by our sense of small self and habits and so on, actually is already like has this compassionate quality. And it's not a matter of like we're trying to become compassionate people. We're not compassionate and we have to like gradually work on it. These Mahayana teachings are more like we're already that way. We just have to remove the blockage that's preventing it. And like Zazen, like that just really being present and still and letting go, we start to, I think, in our experience, we often start to feel like that openness that's we could call compassion, that's actually very easily, you know, even sees like a little mouse or something and feels this connection with it. Oh, I hope it's okay, kind of thing. And I think it's not something that we're creating. I think it's like already here, but we're too busy often to notice it. Yeah.
Yeah, I think you can see stuff like that happen. You know, when there's human circumstances like tragedies, and you have heroes and heroines who sort of rise up and behave in a way that, admittedly, after the fact, they may not have even considered, but it was within their nature to act the way they did when the circumstances arose.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Amazing what people can do in the moment, yeah. when really in touch with great suffering. I think the big disasters like 9/11 and the Japanese tsunami, people comment about how that brings out people who are actually not, don't feel like they're that way, and they come together and help. Yeah.
Yeah, we were just visited when we were in New York a couple of weeks ago, the 9/11 Museum. Huh. And it's really powerful and very moving because literally thousands of people risked their lives and many of them lost them in trying to help others.
Mm-hmm.
It was so powerful to hear the stories of those survivors and those that didn't and what they did.
Yeah.
They just threw it all in and just helped any way they could.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty amazing. Very, very humbling.
So this like compassion as a natural quality of our inherent Buddha nature is I think brought out in some comments on this Zen story. So this story about Daowu and Yunyan and the hands and eyes of compassion is also one of the koans in both the Book of Serenity and the Blue Cliff Record. In both those, you know, maybe most important koan collections, that story is in there. So case 54 in the Book of Serenity. This is in the commentary on this story. The commentator, ancient commentator, brings up another story of two Zen people talking. Li Ao asked Ehu, "What does the great compassionate one do with all those hands and eyes?" So he asks the same question. In our story, the answer is it's like reaching back for a pillow at night. But this other Zen ancient answered, "What does the emperor use public officials for?" Strange, huh? Totally different. So what is the bodhisattva of great compassion you use their all those hands and eyes for? What does the emperor use public officials for? So I hear this as they like to talk in those kind of metaphors. That welcome. The emperor is like the, you know, ruler of the whole empire. Buddha nature. Yeah? The emperor is like this formless, boundless Buddha nature that actually is in charge of everything, but never leaves the room, never does anything, right? The emperor just kind of sits there and issues orders to their, like, ministers to carry out. So I hear this as, it's like Buddha nature just sits there and doesn't actually do anything, but it manifests through these hands and eyes. These hands and eyes do the work of Buddha nature. These are compassionate response. If it's this natural kind of response, like reaching back for a pillow at night, that's just like, that's like that's the ministers carrying out the emperor's command. Mm-hmm. Can you see, get a sense of that? Mm-hmm. We never actually get to meet the emperor directly. He's in the Forbidden Palace. You can't go in there. We never get to see him or her. She's just like regally poised on the throne and just empty, radiantly aware, doesn't do anything, but comes forth. The ministers actually get to go in there, into the inner chambers, and get the orders, and then they come out, and the emperor says, can you go, like, provide food for that whole village? And the ministers go out and do it. So that's like kind of like this Buddha nature. We don't really know what it, we can't really see what it is. It's hidden. It's by definition, it's inconceivable. but it manifests as this compassionate, kind activity. So when the Liao asked Ehu, what is this Bodhisattva great compassion do with these thousand hands and eyes? And Ehu says, what does the emperor use their ministers or public officials for? I think for those who know that Zen poem, Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, it kind of ends with these lines, ministers serve their lords, children obey their parents, not obeying is not filial, and not serving is no help. I think same metaphor. I wondered, what's that about? That sounds kind of kind of harsh maybe. But I think that's what it's talking about. It's a metaphor. Ministers serve their lords. It's like our conscious activity in the world is serving our Buddha nature. The children, which is our hands of helping hands in the world, serve their parents, which is the inconceivable Buddha nature. So that's one comment. This is the Book of Serenity comments on the story. The verse to celebrate the story of Yunnan and Dawu says, since there's some weird stuff going on, just the lines that jumped out at me is, formlessly, selflessly, spring accords with things. The season of spring. Formlessly, selflessly, the season of spring accords with, you know, all the animals and the plants. Unstopped, unhindered, the moon traverses the sky. The present hands and eyes reveal the whole works. We have that term, the Zen key, the total dynamic function, the whole works. The present hands and eyes reveal the whole works. The great function works in all ways. What is taboo? What could be any hindrance? So this is again, you're talking about the function of this inconceivable nature coming forth in this compassionate way formlessly, selflessly, like spring, or like spring, you can't actually say what it is, right? But it has these manifestations, like the flowers all blooming. It's like willow-grown banks and flower-grown walls on a warm day in a gentle breeze. Where's the spring? What shape is it? Nevertheless, it is able to accord with things and come with the time, unstopped, unhindered, like the moon in sky. So this is the function of the hands and eyes of compassion. We can't really see the source of it, but it's how beautiful the manifestation. So that's the Book of Serenity comments and the Blue Cliff Record. This story is case 89. Hands and eyes all over. And this is, we have Hakuin, the great 18th century Japanese Rinzai Zen reviver, Hakuin Zenji, his comments on the Blue Cliff Record. And he's commenting on this line, reaching back for the pillow at night. So just another little image he brings up. His comment on reaching back for the pillow at night is, when you scoop up water, the moon is in your hands. So you picture that, right? It's like you're, either the, you just want to drink this water, this practical thing, and the moon is reflected on the lake there. You scoop it up, it's all like churned up, you don't see the moon, but you hold it as you start to drink it, there's the moon there, like it's the moon being like the ultimate Buddha nature is here in this activity. So in this handful of water, very dynamic, practical functioning water to drink, the moon is there too. It comes with it. You could say, did the moon help you to pick up the water? Maybe. Or maybe you pick up the water and the moon is there. It's like they can't be separated. So this functioning in the world, it can't be separated from the source of just free, unhindered, boundless awareness. Would you like a copy of the text? Oh yeah. What is the Buddha's teaching of his whole lifetime?
Right.
An appropriate response. Yeah, same, same. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yep. This is the appropriate response. Yeah, the coming from that source, the response is appropriate. So again, I think this is why we do these long, tedious sesshins and things like that. Is we're just opening the flow of the source more and more, so that the response comes forth naturally. And you know, maybe if our habits are strong, we also, there's some room for actually training in conventional, like, helping. You know, Tibetan Buddhism has much more of this kind of, like, cultivating compassion through particular exercises. And I think that's helpful. And it seems like the Zen style is more like, we just trust so much in this, in the compassionate nature of the source, we just keep emphasizing coming back to the source, trusting that the response will come forth from there. But maybe you could say, if we don't have a really deep trust, then maybe we need to do more of the conventional trainings. Right? Yeah. So, For those of you who are just arriving, this is the story that Dogen's talking about for the whole rest of the essay. Yunnan says, "What is the Bodhisattva of great compassion do with so many hands and eyes?" And Dawu says, "It's like someone reaching back for a pillow at night." Yunnan says, "Oh, I got it, I got it." Dawu says, "What did you get?" Yunnan said, "All over the body is hands and eyes." Dawu said, "That says it well, but it's only..." Actually, it doesn't say only. "But it's 8 or 9 out of 10. That's 80%. Yunnan said, "I am just like this. How about you? How about yourself, brother?" Dawu said, "Wherever the body reaches, it's hands and eyes. Throughout the body, hands and eyes." So it's the same sentence. One is all over the body is this Chinese character hen that means all over, and throughout the body is this character Xu, which means throughout. Does anyone have a pen or pencil? You maybe can't see this, but looks like maybe some Chinese speakers in the room. Can you see this character? Yeah, I'll pass it around. Su in the Japanese pronunciation is this the kind of central character here. I feel like it means like to pervade or to permeate, to go through. Go directly through, straight through, and it can also mean all over. So hen and su are both mean kind of all over, but su is more like dynamic and like all pervading, maybe. Like the first sentence of Dogen's Fukan Zazengi is the way is basically or originally perfect and all pervading. It's that same character, su. The great way is like penetrating, pervading, permeates everywhere. So I think wherever the body reaches is a little bit of a like a stretch, a little bit of an interpretation, but I really like that. That's the only translation that did that. And I think I like it because I know Joan Halifax is, you know, very engaged, compassionate, actively compassionate teacher. So I just have the sense that maybe she felt like throughout the body is still a little bit like, still sounds like it's just this body, but wherever the body reaches, it's kind of like, seems maybe it includes everybody else too. So it's a nice play. That's how these, you know, you can play with these translations.
So whatever is seen is, it's the eye organ, the seeing, and the object that's seen. That's part of the body.
You could say hands and eyes connect everything. There's really nothing separate.
Knowing.
If we think of someone, we're actually connected. And therefore we have like, you know, we can do well-being ceremonies. We're chanting with the intention of healing someone. And maybe has actually an effect in a way that inconceivably the way that we're really there's no separation. So again, just to mention some of these other translations, because I think this last sentence is a really like a wonderful image to just contemplate. So throughout the body, hands and eyes, which we maybe can feel that kind of response in a visceral sense, right? Like the compassionate function is like in our liver and stuff. It's like throughout the body, hands and eyes. What a great image. Wherever the body reaches its hands and eyes, passing through the body as hands and eyes, pervading the body, hands and eyes, circulating through the body, hands and eyes, the total body, hands and eyes, the whole body is hands and eyes, the thoroughly realized body is hands and eyes. Hands and eyes in accord with the body. All that is intimate with the body is hands and eyes. So that's the kind of dynamism of this character too. Some of those are maybe a little bit stretch, but that's the sense. So now Dogen is going to comment here. In the year 1242, Dogen's most prolific writing time, wrote many Shobo Genzo essays, this time of his life. He's living at Kanondori Kosho Horinji Monastery outside of Kyoto. Dogen's monastery is called Kanon's Guiding Power. Kanondori, so Avalokiteshvara's guiding power is what Dogen named his monastery. And at that Kanondori Kosho Horinji, he's teaching Kanon. He says, although there have been a number of statements about Avalokiteshvara before and after Union and Dawu, they're not as good as the statements made by these two. Praising these ancestors. If you want to study Avalokiteshvara, you should thoroughly investigate their words. And thoroughly investigate is a Japanese term, sankyu, which I feel like is in almost every Shobo Genzo fascicle I've come across. Dogen, many of them anyway, Dogen uses this term. He really likes this term that means study thoroughly, or like examine exhaustively, or investigate to the very bottom. Sankyu. Mm-hmm.
That reminds me of I can't remember. I think it's like the 15th case of Stephen Mitchell's translation of the Dede Ching, which talks about, do you have the patience to wait until your mud settles and the water is clear? Can you remain unmoving until an appropriate response arises by itself?
Yeah.
That's what we're talking about.
Like
here.
That. Mm-hmm.
Linked, I know.
Yeah. Let the compassion come forth.
Yes.
Like the spring permeating the land.
Mm-hmm. But you have to be patient.
Yeah.
So your mud, and how do you know when your mud is clear?
Yeah. We should add a few more days to this. So there's that patiently waiting, and then there's this active, Dogen's active encouragement to thoroughly investigate.
Mm-hmm.
He might say, when you're sitting zazen, just wholeheartedly sit and let go of everything. But when you're studying his writings, then he maybe would encourage us, really like contemplate this story over and over and over again, mm-hmm. and let it percolate through our mind and body, mm-hmm. and throughout the body. The Bodhisattva of great compassion is Avalokiteshvara, one who perceives the cries of the world. That's Kanzeon Bosatsu. Also called one who has complete freedom in perceiving, that's Kanjizai Bosatsu. this bodhisattva is regarded as the father and mother of all Buddhas. Actually, I think the Chinese there says, this bodhisattva is studying or practicing as the father and mother of all Buddhas. Do not assume that this bodhisattva has not mastered the way as much as Buddhas. In fact, Avalokiteshvara was true Dharma illumination to Tathagata in a previous life. So sometimes we say, you know, Buddhas are the ones on their way to, bodhisattvas are on their way to Buddhahood. They're not quite Buddhas yet. And Dogen's saying, the Avalokiteshvara bodhisattva is really just a Buddha, complete Buddha, has mastered the way. Study and focus on Yunyan's words. What does the bodhisattva of great compassion do with so many hands and eyes? There are schools of Buddhism that cherish Avalokiteshvara and schools that have no relationship with this bodhisattva. You know, it's a Mahayana concept, these bodhisattvas. But so like Theravada Buddhism, they're not a big part. But interestingly, like in Thailand, for example, which is completely Theravada country, Guanyin appears for many centuries now, is in there, like in the temples and around. And it's not maybe as emphasized, and they don't read those sutras about her. But it's like, no one can resist her. Bodhisattva of great compassion. But we don't know about those strange Mahayana sutras, but we like that great compassion bodhisattva. That's, you know, remember her. So I think in a way maybe all schools of Buddhism actually have some relationship with her. Yunyan had a connection with Avalokiteshvara and pondered or studied this bodhisattva together with Dawu. Not only one or two, but hundreds and thousands of Avalokiteshvaras study with Yunyan. Actually, it says, Yunyan and his Dharma descendants alone make Avalokiteshvara truly Avalokiteshvara. How is this so? The Avalokiteshvara expressed by Yunyan is thoroughly expressed, while the Avalokiteshvara expressed by others is not. So, Dogen likes it, you know, he picks up a story like this and he's just lavishes praise on these Zen ancestors for their expression. So expressed here is this term, Dotoku, which is the name of another Shobo Genzo essay called Expression, in which Dogen uses in many, many different essays, Dotoku, that means like, what Dogen uses it to mean, like thoroughly expressing something. You know, he says practice is about just sitting and dropping off body and mind, but that's not the whole story. It's not just that passive release. It's also then coming forth and expressing something. For Dogen, it often means in this kind of Zen style of these dialogues, being able to like express something really directly. Well, I don't think it has to be in some special ancient style. It's just a really true, wholehearted, complete expression, I think is what Dogen's praising. Not kind of contrived expression. So, as he's saying, these guys, Yunyan and Dawu, were able to make these true dotoku, complete and unhindered expressions. They didn't just realize compassion of Avalokiteshvara. They could express it by saying things like reaching back for a pillow at night. What an original and unusual expression that just hits the mark directly. So, Avalokiteshvara expressed by others merely has 12 faces, or 11, as this picture on the back shows. 11 faces is a kind of standard number of her faces. But maybe there's some with images with 12. So Dogen's kind of playing with this. Other people express it, like this artist expressed it with 11 faces, but Yun Yan is not like that. Yun Yan's expression of her, the Avalokiteshvara expressed by others, merely has 1,000 hands and eyes, but Yun Yan's Avalokiteshvara is not like that. The Avalokiteshvara expressed by others merely has 84,000 hands and eyes, but Yun Yan's Avalokiteshvara is not like that. You know, it's not limited in any way, right? Just to say, you know, all over the body is hands and eyes, for example. It's funny that he's really praising Yun Yan more than Dao Wu, or, you know, singling out Yun Yan, and even though Dao Wu seems to give the punchlines in the story, doesn't he? Dao Wu is the one who said, reaching back for a pillow at night and throughout the body, hands and eyes. But I imagine maybe Dogen's especially praising Yun Yan to make the point that actually they're equal parts of the conversation. Nobody wins this like debate. They're equally true expressions. And also, Yun Yan is his Dharma ancestor. He's in Dogen's lineage, and Dao Wu is kind of a cousin. How do we know this? There's so many hands and eyes of the Bodhisattva of great compassion expressed by Yun Yan is not limited to 84,000 or 12 or 32 or 3. Remember, there's 33, the 33 manifestations of a canon from the Lotus Sutra and so on. So many means a great many. Or so many could be translated like limitlessly abundant. You know, wherever it's in italics here, his quote, that's a quote from the original, you know, it's characters from the original story. So what does the Bodhisattva of great compassion do with limitlessly abundant hands and eyes? It's as many as possible, not limited to any number. As it's not limited to any number, it's not limited to beyond boundary and measure. So this is Dogen like trying to push every possible limitation beyond itself. And he likes to do these things. Like, so it's not limited to any boundary, but it's also not limited to beyond boundary. And the translator put in parentheses, not limited to the infinite. You know, it's not limited to any finite number, but it's also not limited to the infinite. I think hearing, if we really thoroughly investigate or really hear those kind of words, when I hear that a few times, it starts to break down my limited mind. You know how that is? Like, okay, this is really, really boundless what Dogen's talking about here. But like it's more boundless than it's not limited by boundlessness.
Yeah. It's not dualistic.
Therefore it can be bound.
Therefore it can be bound. Yeah.
A particular.
Yeah. Right. So Zen is often into this dynamic. If it starts to get too far out of one way, it comes back. So like there's the Zen stories like all things return to the one. But where does the one return to? And the answer is like, you know, this piece of paper came from Office Depot. So getting into this.
And it can be measured.
And it can be measured, yeah. It's like a particular thing that came from a particular place. It's very, very mundane. It's like, so we're getting into this vision of like oneness beyond all comprehension. Well, where does that return? It's like this, you know, a very particular point. So that's kind of the dynamic of this paragraph of Dogen here. It's study the scale of so many in this way, or another translation, study the arithmetic of the limitless, the limitlessly abundant in this way. It even goes beyond the boundary of beyond boundary and measure. When Yunyan asked this question, Dawu did not disapprove of it. He saw deep meaning in the question. Yunyan and Dawu studied shoulder to shoulder in Yaoshan's community and journeyed or practiced together for 40 years. This is, remember, that Yunyan practiced with Baijan for 20 years, and then he went to Yaoshan's Zen Center and practiced with him for 40 more years. So there, you know, that's how they could maybe get to this kind of really thorough expression of things. They just spent a long time doing this kind of work. Investigating ancient and new cases or teachings. This word cases here is yinan, which means literally like causes and conditions. And causes and conditions means causes and conditions, but it's also a Zen phrase for like Dharma teachings. Like we have this one chant that says, thoroughly examine these causes and conditions as this practice is the transmission of a verified Buddha. So that's part of the meaning there, is thoroughly examine this teaching that he just gave. Investigating these ancient and new teachings and causes and conditions, they rejected incorrect views and confirmed each other's understanding. Having been together like this, Yunyan presented his understanding on that day, and Dawu confirmed it. So, having been together like this, the words like this is this phrase, Imo, which is the name of another Shobo Genzo essay called Like This, or Such, or Thus. So, it's a little like Dogen like to play with these words, that just the normal meaning. They were together like this. They practiced like this, but it also means they practiced thus, which is this Buddhist term for like the ineffable suchness of the way things are. They practiced together in suchness, and Dawu confirmed Yunyan. Confirmed is shomei. In Rinzai Zen, they have this term, Inka Shomei. We don't really use it in Soto Zen, but it's like approval, it's like a seal of approval of understanding. But Dogen uses Shomei here. Show is the same as like, when we say practice and verification are not two, it's that verification or confirmation is show. Know that the many words, many hands and eyes were equally expressed by these two ancient Buddhas. The words many hands and eyes were studied simultaneously by Yunyan and Dawu. One page. So, any new thoughts or expressions, yes?
I'm fascinated by how to train the brain away from its sensory focus. And in a way, it sounds like this is saying to train your brain away from sensory focus, you have to go through thousand eyes and hands, all sensory experience.
Yeah, yeah. So, there's all kinds of different Buddhist meditation, but the Zen tradition, general, and also other like Tibetan traditions, emphasize actually keeping all the senses really open. Mm. Yeah, maybe earlier Indian Buddhist meditations were like you sit with your eyes closed, as silent as possible. Is the best, and almost like you're shutting down the senses to, and going really, really inward. And there's some aspects of that in Zen too. Of course, we're not trying to get caught up in the sensory world. Like we hear those they sound like jays, huh? Stellar jays, squawking. So you can like listen to them. I wonder what they're saying. Where they are? What are they thinking about? We try not to go with the content of the sensory input, but we do actually like let the sound come in. And we sit in this tradition, generally sit with eyes open a little bit. I don't know if everybody does that, and sometimes I think maybe eyes closed is good sometimes, but you know, Dogen really emphasized keeping our eyes open just a little bit, not focusing on anything to get like caught up in the visual perception in front of us, but just letting in some light. And and I think it's that in that spirit of like nothing's being blocked. It's just like a very open kind of meditation, and nothing's blocked, and yet we're also not like going out. The mind's not going out and getting caught up in the external sensory objects, which is just a wonderful space to be in, where everything's happening, but we're so present that we're not caught in it. I think that's the key thing, because if we're really, really devoted to like the present moment, then like you can't keep a story going, because the story about the blue jay squawk is already, the squawk's already gone, or we're thinking about, you know, the last squawk or something. If we're really freshly in the present, it's like squawk, that's gone now. There's butt. Now there's a car. Now there's a mosquito, and so that listening to the sounds of the world is like a practice of like really present, open awareness. Hard to do. It's maybe easier in a way to kind of like try to shut out, focus so intently on the breath, for example, that like we actually don't even know if there's any sound happening. Sometimes you can get there. Or the other extreme of like, we're totally like just trying to catch every detail of the sound, or in a kind of effortful way. But in between those two is like just the present open space of now with sounds and bodily sensations is another sense, and the colors in the eye, and that kind of openness. I think part of, sometimes I've thought that part of the reason why Zen and this really spacious kind of meditations of the Tibetan tradition emphasize all the senses open is because it's closer to everyday life. You know, if we're going really, really inward in like a super concentrated, absorption state, it's like then when we open our eyes again, it's like a whole new thing, and we're like, it's a very, very different from the meditation. But if we're already sitting with eyes and ears open, then maybe we can like actually stand up, start walking, or still like it's almost the same kind of zazen, because you can function in the world with your senses open, you can move about, so you can continue to some extent that kind of really spacious zazen mind in activity. So there's less separation between the meditation and the activity. Yes.
Yeah, I read something from Suzuki Roshi once upon a time. He said something about there needing to be great doubt like in zazen, so that sort of moment-to-moment awareness, and he describes it like a gigantic question mark without an answer. And so where does that sort of fit in to the equation?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes... whose pen is this? Thanks. You know, in Rinzai Zen, they actually talk about cultivating great doubt, which is like having this really like almost like burning obsession to resolve the great matter. But maybe Suzuki Roshi's doubt, that is just, I picture it anyway, as kind of just like an open sense of wonder. Like just that big question mark is a nice image. Like, nothing's fixed. It's like, this is how it is. It's more like, it's like don't know mind. Like Bodhidharma's not knowing. I just, what's actually happening here? I don't know. And it's a mind of openness, that question mark. That's how I would hear that kind of doubt, as opposed to like using some more narrower sense of doubt to kind of bore through something, which could be done too, but maybe they're a little bit different.
John, you brought up that video of Suzuki Roshi talking about the Blue Jays.
Yeah.
And one of the things he says is the Blue Jay is here in my mind already. So we understand sounds are something that we make. Like how that connects to the sensory thing,
yeah.
Like even the visual field, that the visual field we produce, the objects that are part of it, are something that we create.
Yeah. Which is a little bit, I can't remember who was here when I brought up one of the sutra teachings of Avalokiteshvara in the Sharangama Sutra, where Avalokiteshvara is explaining how she realized the way, and she says, I don't just contemplate sounds, I contemplate the contemplator of sounds. So it's like you're listening to the Blue Jay, and then I think we can get really present with that experience, where there's not much of any discursive thinking about it, but then there's this other little step that could be done, which is like turning back the awareness of like, there's this awareness listening to sound, and then look back at like, what is the awareness actually? And that's, I think, kind of like that space too, where the sound falls into the awareness. And then there's no separation at all anymore. The sound's not outside us. The sound is the awareness.
And what he's saying is that we make that sound. Who is making that sound?
Well, that's the question. Yeah, who? Yeah, who is like, is Avalokiteshvara's practice to ask that? Who is making the sound actually? If it's not actually the Blue Jay, if it's this mind, or actually, without even landing anywhere, to actually just ask, who is making the sound? Or where is this really coming from? I think that question is like that question mark. Yeah? And hopefully there's no answer. That we look back and a lot of these practices, like who is this, right? These questions, like, if there were some answer, it would be like, we wouldn't get anywhere. But the questions that are designed to take us to the inconceivable, unanswerable source. But not just to, you see, the problem is that if we know, well, I know I'm not going to find anybody, so who is it? Yeah, there's nobody really. Okay, done with that. Next experiment? I think we have to like really deep, we have to take it really seriously, ask, thoroughly investigate, Sankyu. Who is sitting here? Who is having this experience? Who is this? And to really then directly realize, wow, it's not who I thought it was. And that's like the kind of the freedom, that we can't find anybody here that's having an experience. And that one that we can't find, you could say, is what makes the sound of the Blue Jay. So, should we collect the teacups? Maybe someone could pass the tray.
Mm-hmm.
keep them.
What's that?
We'll keep them.
Oh, keep them. Okay, keep them. Yeah, yeah. Shall we keep the teacups? And go back to sitting. So heat is a nice sensory experience, especially if you have like many layers of clothing, to feel the drips of sweat slowly trickle down, like little massage. So delightful. May Guan Shu Yin's great compassion fill the boundless universe, easing the pain of all beings. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.